This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Screenwriter and director Paul Haggis left the Church of Scientology in 2009 after writing an angry letter about the church to its spokesperson. Haggis had been a member of the church for nearly 35 years. He's spoken publicly about his departure for the first time to journalist Lawrence Wright. In the current edition of The New Yorker, Wright profiles Haggis and investigates the Church of Scientology through interviews with other former members of the church and through church documents and military documents about its founder, L. Ron Hubbard. Wright's article is titled The Apostate, Paul Haggis versus the Church of Scientology. Haggis wrote the screenplay for the film Million Dollar Baby. He wrote and directed Crash. Each of those movies won an Oscar for Best Picture. Lawrence Wright is also the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book The Looming Tower about the history of Al-Qaeda. The book includes a history of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which we'll talk about a little later. Lawrence Wright, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry.
So your story revolves around Paul Haggis. Who approached who? Did you approach him or did he approach you?
No, I approached him. When he dropped out of Scientology, I was very intrigued because I was an admirer of his work. I thought Crash especially was a wonderful movie. And I got his business manager's telephone number and called him and said I would like to write an article, a profile of Paul, apropos of his decision to leave the Church of Scientology. And the response was, "Are you kidding? We would never do that."
Why not?
And it's a subject that's very thorny and controversial. The business manager's opinion was that Paul didn't need that kind of attention. And then I got hold of Paul's personal email address, and I sent him a note, and I said, "Your business manager says this is not the right time, but if there's ever a time when you'd like to tell the story of your, as I said, intellectual and spiritual development, I'd love to be the one to do that." And 20 minutes later, I got a note from him saying, "Very flattered, let's have lunch on Tuesday." And so we did. During the course of the lunch, I said, "Of course, the story is occasioned by your decision to leave the church." And his eyes got a little wide, but only later in another interview did he admit that it had never occurred to him that we were going to talk about Scientology. He was just so flattered that the New Yorker had taken an interest in him. So it was just a lucky misunderstanding on my part.
So how did he agree to talk with you about Scientology?
Well, I was really surprised how candid and open he was. You know, although from the beginning, he was a little guarded to when we started, and he had never talked about it in public, and actually with very few of his friends as well. And many of the questions that I was asking over the course of the nearly 10 months that it took to do this story, he had never really asked himself. So there was a process of discovery for him as well, I believe, in the course of the writing of this article.
Why were you interested in talking to a former Scientologist? Why were you interested in Scientology?
Well, Terry, I've always been intrigued by why people believe one thing over another. The U.S. is such an unusual place in the world because you can believe anything you want. There's a lot of countries in the world where that's not true. But here, freedom of belief is like a supermarket. You can choose to believe anything. And that opens up the question, why would you believe this over something else? And in the course of my career, I've written about the Amish, I've written about Mormons, Southern Baptists, much about Islam. So I've spent a lot of time interviewing people about their beliefs, and Scientology has always been intriguing to me because it's such a stigmatized religion. And why people would be drawn to something that has so many negative connotations around it, I thought there must be something that this religion offers them. And that's what I wanted to find out.
Do you feel like you got an answer to that?
Yeah, I found that especially in talking to Paul in the early days of his association with Scientology, he felt that it helped him with his relationship, it helped him with his career, gave him a sense of how interpersonal relations work, He was not so infatuated with the theology that he later got into, but in the first part of his association, he felt that he was very rewarded by his involvement in Scientology.
Well, let's get to why Paul Haggis not only left Scientology, but he left very angry with Scientology. He wrote a very angry letter to Tommy Davis, who's Scientology's spokesperson. What are some of the things Paul Haggis criticized about Scientology in that letter of departure?
To begin with, his upset with the church had to do with Proposition 8, the 2008 California ballot initiative that would forbid gay marriage. Two of Paul's three daughters are gay, and one of the churches in Scientology in San Diego had affiliated with the forces that were proposing this proposition. They had assigned their names to this proposition, the supporters. And when that came to Paul's attention, he wrote a letter to Tommy asking the church to formally renounce that affiliation with the supporters of Proposition 8 and actually take a stand against it. He thought that the church should, having made that mistake, should be more forthright and stand against it. And Davis responded that the church didn't engage in those kinds of political activities. It would stir up more trouble if we renounced it, and he thought that if we could just simply issue a statement saying that it had been a mistake, that would leave it. That he would leave it there, but that was not satisfactory to Haggis, and he began an investigation of Scientology, something that he had not done in his nearly 35 years as being a Scientologist. He had never really looked at what people said about Scientology. And in fact, the church discourages that kind of independent inquiry.
There was a meeting that you referred to in your article about Scientology where people from the New Yorker staff met with representatives from Scientology. What was this meeting about?
It was one of the most amazing days of my life. I had been out to Los Angeles to interview Tommy Davis over Memorial Day weekend, and when he finally did come to meet with me, he said that he had decided not to talk to me. But I asked him if he would agree at least to respond to our fact-checking queries about the church. And he agreed to that. And over a period of time, we sent them 971 fact-checking queries, which alarmed them. And so in September, Tommy Davis and four Scientology lawyers arrive in New York with 47 volumes of supporting material, these binders that stretch 7 linear feet. And we met in a conference room at 10 in the morning with me and two of the checkers and the head of our checking department and our lawyer and my editor and David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, who had just come in to welcome everyone but took a seat and didn't get up till 6 that evening. The whole day was quite fascinating because it was finally my opportunity to interview Tommy Davis and learn about the Church of Scientology. And it was a revelatory meeting in many respects. And the material that he was able to produce in these binders has been very useful to us.
So what did you ask him? What's one of your most interesting questions in his responses?
Well, I think probably the most critical response had to do with the founder of the church, L. Ron Hubbard. In some of the material that I had been reading and in some of my interviews, there was a big question about Hubbard's his war record and his medical history. He had said that at the end of World War II, he was blind and a hopeless cripple, and that he had healed himself through these measures that later became the basis of Dianetics, which is the book that he wrote in 1950 out of which Scientology arises. And I had found evidence that Hubbard was never actually injured during the war. And so In one very interesting moment, Davis said, of course, if it's true that Mr. Hubbard was never injured during the war, then he never did heal himself using Dianetics principles, then Dianetics is based on a lie, and then Scientology is based on a lie. The truth is that Mr. Hubbard was a war hero. And the way he phrased that, that everything depended on whether Hubbard had sustained these injuries and had healed himself, was like a wager on the table. And so we pressed him for evidence that there had been such injuries and he had been the war hero that he described. And eventually, Davis sent us what is called a notice of separation. It's essentially discharge papers from World War II, which, along with some photographs of all these medals that he had won, a Purple Heart with a palm, other commendations from different countries and so on. At the same time, we finally gained access to Hubbard's entire World War II records. And there was no evidence that he had ever been wounded in battle or distinguished himself in any way during the war. So we also found another notice of separation, which was strikingly different from the one that that the church had provided.
So did you show those documents to Tommy Davis, the Scientology spokesperson?
One of the most interesting moments in the meeting is when I asked Tommy Davis to square the records that we had with the church's own records of Mr. Hubbard's war records. And he said, well, we, the church, were also puzzled about it until we found an expert who clarified all this. And he said the man who did that was Mr. X, in Oliver Stone's movie JFK, who in real life was a man named Fletcher Prouty, who had been involved in inner circles of American Defense Department. And Prouty, who also had worked for the church, had told them that Hubbard had actually been an intelligence agent and the records were, as he said, sheep-dipped. It's apparently a term of art in intelligence that maintains that there were two sets of records. And we obtained all of Mr. Hubbard's military records, and there was no second set of records. There was no evidence that he had ever acted as an intelligence agent during the war in any serious capacity, and that he had never been wounded.
So is this where we stand now, that Scientology has a set of L. Ron Hubbard's military records that say one thing, you have a set that says another, and you believe the records you have and they believe the records they have? Is that where we are?
Well, it's more than that, Terry. The notice of separation they gave us was signed by an individual named Howard Thompson, a lieutenant commander who apparently never existed. They gave us a photograph of the medals that Mr. Hubbard supposedly had won. Two of them weren't even commissioned until after he left active service. On there it says that he graduated after 4 years of college and got a civil engineering degree, which is not accurate. There were a number of different discrepancies on there that make it pretty clear that it's not an actual record.
How do you know that the person who signed this record doesn't exist?
In the 900-some-odd pages of Hubbard's war records, there were numerous letters from other researchers over the years, and one of them had inquired about Howard D. Thompson, this lieutenant commander that supposedly signed this notice of separation. And the archivist at the time said that they had thoroughly researched the roles of Navy officers at the time, and there was no such person.
So at this meeting, Tommy Davis said if it was true that L. Ron Hubbard wasn't blind, wasn't sick, and didn't heal himself, then that would mean that Dianetics was a lie and that Scientology was a lie. Am I getting that right?
That's correct.
So you're presenting him with what you say is evidence that Hubbard lied. So what has Tommy Davis said in response?
They say they have an expert, whose name he didn't give us, who says that these records are authentic.
So here's where we stand now, that Tommy Davis, the spokesperson of Scientology, is maintaining that the record that he has, that Scientology has, of L. Ron Hubbard's notice of separation from the military, basically the document when he left the military, is true, it's authentic, and you're saying, no, that's a forgery. The document that you got is the authentic one.
I do say that. I mean, there's 900-some-odd pages in Hubbard's military records that authenticate the accuracy of the notice of separation that is in the military archives in St. Louis, and none of that authenticates the many wounds or valor that the Church of Scientology maintains they have in their records.
Scientology is usually described as a fairly secretive organization, at least secretive at the top. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to fact-check a piece about Scientology? And I should mention here that Scientology does have a reputation of suing when it feels it's been misrepresented.
Yeah, they're an aggressive and litigious organization, at least they have been so in the past. And so we've tried to be extremely careful with this. We've had 5 fact-checkers involved in this story. Even the head of the fact-checking department weighed in. And one of the checkers was on the story almost full-time since August. So, I don't think in the magazine's history, I can't imagine that we've ever devoted that kind of scrupulousness to one single story. And this is a magazine that prides itself on its checking. But this story in particular had to be very, very carefully vetted, and it has been.
And I should say that I think nearly everything that the defectors maintain happened within Scientology. Scientology, the Scientology organization, claims was not true, just to represent their point of view here.
That's right. The church, they maintain that Mr. Hubbard was a war hero and did have the injuries that he claimed to have. And essentially, on all of these factual matters, they issue largely a blanket denial.
So the document that you have, L. Ron Hubbard's notice of separation, what impact do you think that is going to have on Scientology?
It's hard to measure because we're dealing with a religion. And people are drawn to it because of faith. And if it were simply a matter of reason, then one could put this document down in front of you and say, here is conclusive proof that the founder of Scientology lied about his military record and lied about his injuries and lied about the very fundamental principles out of which he created the Church of Scientology. But that may not matter to people who are involved in it, who may feel that they are gaining something from their experience, either because they feel like the truths of Scientology enhance their lives or because the community of Scientologists that they live among is something like their family. So they intentionally shield themselves against knowing these kinds of things.
So your article about Paul Haggis leaving Scientology challenges one of the basic premises of Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard's teachings. So how has your article, the investigation you've done, and the reading that Paul Haggis has done, changed Paul Haggis?
Oh, it's interesting because I was privy to a lot of those changes just by asking him questions that he had never really asked himself about things that the church had engaged in the past, some of the controversies that have haunted the church for decades, he never really looked at. And in the process of interviewing him, he would sometimes stop and say, I think of myself as being a very skeptical and independent person, but I don't know why I didn't ask myself these very questions at the time. It was between a lack of interest and a fear of finding out the truth.
Lawrence Wright's article, The Apostate, Paul Haggis versus the Church of Scientology, is published in the current edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the questions facing Egypt is what role the Islamist group, the Muslim Brotherhood, will play in the future. The group supports an Islamic State. The Brotherhood has been officially banned since 1954, but members of the group have served in Egypt's parliament. As the Washington Post points out today, the group has a split image here, as a hostile Islamic organization whose fundamentalist wing could be dangerous for the United States if it took control, and as a band of aging revolutionaries who would play a vital but minority role in any coalition government. Lawrence Wright describes the history of the group in his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. Lawrence Wright taught English at the American University in Cairo and has made many reporting trips to Egypt. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood participated in the meeting on Sunday with other leaders of the opposition in talks with Omar Suleiman, the vice president, the new vice president of Egypt. And after that, they said they're uncertain if they'll continue to participate in these talks or if they'll withdraw. There's been so much speculation about what the Muslim Brotherhood stands for now and what their participation in the creation of a new government would mean. What is the Muslim Brotherhood's philosophy now?
Well, you can't say that it's just one philosophy because the Brotherhood itself is fractured. And there are different factions within it that some are, you know, the Brotherhood in Egypt has made a decision that in general they agree with democratic politics. But originally, that was not the case. And so there are, let's say, hardliners, there are moderates, and there are progressives who want to be much more a part of the modern world. So it's difficult for that organization, although it's certainly the most coherent political opposition party in Egypt. Even within that organization, there are factions, and no doubt right now they're really churning about how they're going to react to the situation in Egypt.
The group has officially denounced violence, and they're not on good terms with al-Qaeda, even though bin Laden and his number two, Ayman al-Zawahiri, were once members of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah, in fact, Ayman al-Zawahiri wrote a book called Bitter Harvest, in which he attacked the Muslim Brotherhood because of its willingness to engage in politics. And he never misses an opportunity to lambast the Muslim Brotherhood and even its offshoot Hamas in Gaza.
Let's go back to the early history of the Muslim Brotherhood. The group was founded in 1928. Who founded it and why did he create it?
Well, Hassan al-Banna was the founder, and it was a period of time when Egypt was still under British colonial rule, although there was a king, Farouk, who was, you know, the nominal ruler of the country. And many Egyptians were looking for a way to establish their own identity. And Hassan al-Banna was a very religious man, and he created really the first Islamist organization. Until that point, Islam had not really been engaged in politics. It wasn't a political force. Most Muslims saw Islam as being separate from political affairs. It was the religion. And what's significant about the Muslim Brotherhood is that they took the religion and combined it with politics. This was a force that had never really appeared in the Islamic world before then. And Islamism is what we call it. But that force was transfigurative of politics, not just in Egypt, but in the entire region.
And by Islamism, you mean that the state should be an Islamic state under Islamic law?
That's correct.
So was his goal to have Egypt under Islamic law or to have that kind of spread through the Arab world?
Well, Hassan al-Banna was a nationalist, and his focus was very much on Egypt, although I'm sure he cast his eye over the horizon. But Egyptians believe that Egypt is the heart and soul of the Arab world, at least, and that, even Gamal al-Nasser, who took control of Egypt in the 1952 revolution, had the same feeling that where Egypt went, the rest of the Arab world would follow.
Now, one of the members of the Muslim Brotherhood early on, who became their kind of ideological and spiritual leader in a lot of ways, was Sayyid Qutb, who also helped inspire al-Qaeda. Tell us a little about him and his role in the Muslim Brotherhood.
Actually, he was a kind of rival, or at least in his mind, to Hassan al-Banna. Early on, Sayyid Qutb came to America in 1948. He was more or less run out of Egypt at the time. He was writing articles against the king and against the British, and it became politically inconvenient for him to be in Egypt. So he left Egypt and came to America for a couple of years and hated America, hated his experience here. But when he returned to Egypt, Hassan al-Banna had been assassinated by Egyptian security forces, and there was a vacuum inside the Muslim Brotherhood, which Sayyid Qutb filled. He became, very powerful ideologue, and he also was allied with the very violent faction within the Muslim Brotherhood.
So how did that change the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, that faction that Sayyid Qutb was engaged with, they tried to assassinate Gamal Nasser in 1954. And in result, Nasser rounded them up and threw them all in prison and eventually hanged Sayyid Qutb, who became a martyr to the cause. But for many years, the leadership of the Muslim Brothers were in the prisons in Egypt. And that was very formative. It's in those prisons that they spent a lot of time working out their ideology and their dogma. I was living in Egypt, as a matter of fact, when Nasser died. His successor, Anwar Sadat, a very pious man himself, decided to release the Muslim Brothers from prison. And ironically, it was that decision, in many respects, that led to his assassination.
How so?
Many of the radical elements of that organization were so opposed to Sadat's decision to sign a peace treaty with Israel, and also other things that they objected to, for instance, his view about women's rights and the need for women to dress in the hijab, the head covering, which Sadat ridiculed as a tent. They were furious with him. And so when they had the opportunity, they killed him.
So when did the Muslim Brotherhood renounce violence?
After the death of Sayyid Qutb, a new leader, Hassan al-Hudaybi, became the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood. And he wrote a refutation, or let's say a counter-argument, to the ideology that Sayyid Qutb had propagated, arguing for a much more moderate place in the society. And that dynamic between Sayyid Qutb and Hudaybi continues to this day. The tension in that relationship is reflected not only in the Muslim Brotherhood but in other Islamist groups around the Muslim world. And it wasn't until the mid-80s that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt made the decisive step of actually running for office, and that has defined modern Muslim Brotherhoods to this day.
And when you say running for office, there isn't a Muslim Brotherhood party because the Muslim Brotherhood is officially banned, but members of the Muslim Brotherhood have served in parliament.
That's correct. The voters know who they're voting for, but the party has been banned.
So was Mubarak president at the time that the Muslim Brotherhood renounced violence?
Yes. And since then, they really haven't engaged in the kind of violence that they had in the past. You know, this is an organization that's been around a long time, you know, over 80 years old now, which is unusual for any of those kind of political parties in Egypt. It's certainly the oldest and now the most established party in the country. It has a long history of civil service. It has learned and evolved in many of its political views. When I was living there, the only political idea the Muslim Brotherhood had was to put headscarves on women. And now, you know, Islam is the solution was the only thing that they had to say. But now they've been in politics for a long time, and they've had to cope with a lot of real problems, education, illiteracy, and those kinds of things that where simple statements don't really satisfy. And so answering to the voters, I think, has been an educative process for those people.
What do you think they represent now?
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out, Terry, because, you know, they've said they are not going to field a candidate for president. And to me, that was one of the most remarkable things that's come out of this very tumultuous and interesting period in Egypt. They have an opportunity to put forward their own candidate, but they recognize that the West is terrified of seeing Egypt turn into an Islamist state. They also recognize that the Mubarak administration has for years used the Muslim Brotherhood as a kind of scapegoat in giving credence to the fears that the Islamists will take over if Mubarak and his henchmen leave office. So I think very wisely they declared they're not going to run a candidate, which vitiates that whole argument that that they are after Mubarak comes the deluge. I think it's that decision alone could really be the turning point in what happens in these next several days.
If the Muslim Brotherhood plays a part in the new government but doesn't run a candidate, and if the Muslim Brotherhood participates in the government and doesn't try to like overthrow it or undermine it or create a theocracy, what significance would that have in the larger Islamist movement?
It's going to allow the Muslim Brotherhood to find its proper place, its proper size inside Egyptian civil society. We don't really know what size of a constituency they have, but I suspect that it wouldn't be over 30% at the maximum. The reason they seem so outsized is that other organized opposition has been so crippled by the Mubarak administration, simply hasn't been allowed to function and organize. So other parties, more secular or even more radical, simply haven't had a chance to get their roots out among the people. And if the Mubarak regime comes down, it seems likely, it's pretty clear that there needs to be a period of time where people actually have the opportunity to organize new parties with new candidates. One of the real problems in Egypt is that there just aren't very many Democrats. They haven't had that experience, and they're going to have it in an extremely compressed period of time.
Why has the Muslim Brotherhood been able to function even though it has been banned for decades?
They have terrific discipline in a country where that's unusual among political organizations, tremendous amount of commitment. It's one of the very few organizations that people trust as not being corrupt, and that gives them credibility among the population that may not entirely agree with their religious perspectives. But they realize that they can count on them to be much more honest and much more helpful in an emergency than the government has been.
Does the Muslim Brotherhood still stand for creating an Islamic state in Egypt?
I think there's no doubt that that's their ultimate goal. But I think they also recognize that they're going to be a long way from getting there. A large portion of the Muslim Brotherhood agenda is what they call dawah, which is spreading the word and trying to convince people to come over to their side. And I think that what they're engaging in now is, you know, they're going to work in ordinary politics, they're going to participate, but they're going to carry out their dawah and see if they can persuade the country to become more Islamist in the future. Whether they can do that will be a matter of how people respond to their message.
Where do they stand? Where does the Muslim Brotherhood stand on Israel now?
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood has made many different statements about Israel. There are members of the Muslim Brotherhood who absolutely believe that Israel has to be eliminated. And remember that Hamas is an offshoot of the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. And their views are powerfully reflected in the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood. On the other hand, there are members of the Muslim Brotherhood who say that the treaties will be honored. So I think, once again, we see a division within that organization.
Do you know where the Muslim Brotherhood stands on Coptic Christians in Egypt and other religious minorities there?
There are several different crises that the Brotherhood is going to be facing in terms of trying to exert its power in Egypt. One is the role of women, and which is still not clear that it's willing to accept the kind of modern terms that most Egyptians want where women are concerned. Another is the role of minorities, and especially the Coptic Christians. In the past, many Islamists in Egypt have said that they would not accept, for instance, a Christian to be president of the country. It's one of the parts of Islamist dogma is that in an Islamist state, that minorities will pay a tax for the privilege of living in an Islamic country. It's going to be difficult for the brothers to renounce that, impossible for them to rule in a majoritarian way in a democratic country if they don't accept the participation of other religious minorities. And then the third thing will be its stance on the existence of Israel. Those three things are going to be facing the brothers in a very short space of time, I think, and it'll define whether that organization will be an active and vital part of Egypt's future or if they will be relegated to some sort of crank religious party that will gradually become less and less relevant.
So there's a lot of people in America now who are really afraid of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they have been, by some people, made into a boogeyman. And certainly Mubarak made them into a boogeyman. I mean, Mubarak basically has said that if there is a democracy, the Muslim Brotherhood are going to take over. It will become an Islamic extremist state. And, you know, America won't like the outcome. A lot of Egyptians wouldn't like the outcome. And it would change the whole Middle East. So what do you think of the fear of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and in the United States?
Well, fear is never the best principle to organize around. And Sayed Adin Ibrahim, for instance, was a very distinguished sociology professor at the American University in Cairo, where I taught. And he did a study back in the 70s, I think, about Muslim Brothers and, you know, what percentage of the population they actually represented, and which was a very small one at the time. And Mubarak government put him in prison for other reasons, they claim. But I think it was the findings of that study that showed that there really wasn't such an Islamist threat in Egypt. The Egyptian government has kept this alive for a long time, and the Muslim Brothers provide a very convenient scapegoat for them. That's why the decision on the part of the Brotherhood not to run a candidate for president, I think, is so astute, because it removes that scapegoat from this discussion, at least at the present time.
What do you think about the fear that some people have that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to work hard to turn Egypt into Islamist state and set a tone for other countries to become Islamist states?
Well, I think they will, Terry. There's no doubt that that's their goal. And in a democratic society, they would have the freedom to do that. It would be up to other parties who differ with them to work equally hard to prove themselves.
So that's what you think is ahead?
I think that it's a contest, and I think the Islamists have an advantage in that they have a long history, they're well organized, they're committed to their goals. What we have is a kind of vacancy in the opposition that is yet to be filled by leaders. Those people out in the streets of Tahrir, most of them are not Islamists, but they don't have proper leaders at this point. They may come forward. They may materialize. Sometimes you see in great revolutionary movements, extraordinary figures make themselves known. That hasn't happened yet in Egypt. We're waiting for those figures to come into view. And until that happens, the Muslim Brothers will have an outsized advantage that's much, much greater than their actual numbers. But if the opposition parties can find their leaders and organize around their principles and make their statements known to other Egyptians, then I think that we will see an actual democracy in Egypt in which the Muslim Brothers play a part, but not a decisive one.
Now, because you wrote a book about al-Qaeda, you're probably very aware of Egypt's role in supplying a lot of intelligence to the United States. I mean, it's one of the real bases of the alliance for America. So you probably understand that part of the relationship. Can you explain a little bit about the nature of Egypt's cooperation in helping the United States keep tabs on terrorists?
Egypt has been extremely helpful to the United States during the war on terror, and it has a very, very close alliance with our intelligence agencies. So they work extremely closely together, and they work frequently on cases together. So one would have to say that it's been hand in glove between U.S. intelligence and Egyptian intelligence.
And how much of that part of the relationship between the United States and Egypt is at risk now?
I don't know if that's going to change anything. The Egyptians themselves have been traumatized, if anything, more than Americans by terrorism. During the 90s, there was a terrorist war on the state of Egypt, and more than 1,000 Egyptians were killed. The battles between the state security agencies and the terrorists was unbelievably bloody and savage on both sides. And so I don't think that Egyptians have much tolerance right now for terrorists in their midst. We have a common interest in subduing the terrorist elements in both our societies. So I don't see that changing very much regardless of who comes to power in Egypt.
Finally, are you amazed at what's going on in Egypt? You spent a lot of time there over the years. You taught English in Cairo.
Terry, this is it's thrilling to me. I just hope so much that it comes out all right. You know, this is a country that has long been ready for democracy, but many of those civil institutions, you know, back when the king was there in the 40s and 50s, it was in many respects more of a democracy than it ever has been before or since. So it has a tradition of democratic participation in politics. It's just been so crippled by such a long period of semi-military rule and dictatorship. Now there's finally a chance for the people to exercise their voice. And what happens in Egypt is going to ripple out all over not just the Arab world, but the entire Muslim world, I'm convinced. people are waiting to see what's going to happen in Egypt. And, you know, there are many examples in the world of revolutions that have gone poorly, and this could be one of them. Certainly in that neighborhood, there are many, you know, typically we're in the Middle East, and typically things don't turn out well. But this is the most promising moment in the long time that I've known Egypt, and I'm just praying that the principles of nonviolence and justice and democratic freedom take root in that country and are allowed to prosper. And in that case, I think Egypt will become one of the great countries of the world, as it should be.
Lawrence Wright, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Terry.
Lawrence Wright is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower, Al-Qaeda and the Road to 9/11. He's also a staff writer for The New Yorker. In the current edition, he writes about the Church of Scientology. You can find links to the article and to primary source documents obtained by The New Yorker about Scientology's founder, L. Ron Hubbard, on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is NPR.